Spring is in full bloom. Are your finances? With the Chime Secured Credit Builder Visa Credit Card, you can build credit with everyday purchases and regular on-time payments, all with no annual fees or interest. With Chime Secured Credit Card, you can start improving your credit scores right away. Get started today at chime.com/build. That's chime.com/build. Chime. Feels like progress.
The Chime Credit Builder Visa Credit Card is issued by Bancorp Bank N.A. or Stride Bank N.A. Members FDIC. Out-of-network ATM withdrawal and OTC advance fees may apply. Terms and conditions apply. Go to chime.com/disclosures for details.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Have you heard you can listen to your favorite news podcasts ad-free? Good news. With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts included with your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or visit amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree, and catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to. Lots to talk about. The Twitters today had Westboro Baptist Church trending. And I'm like, you know, nothing good ever comes out of Westboro Baptist Church trending in any way, shape, or form. So immediately I know without even looking that there have got to be some idiots out protesting a funeral. Because if you remember Fred Phelps and his band of lunatics, anytime there was a funeral of someone in the LGBTQ community, they showed up with their signs. And you've seen all of it. I don't want to go through the insanity of that. And so today this was trending, and I'm going, please tell me they didn't dig Fred Phelps back up to drag him to something else. Well, no, they didn't. There was a pro-Palestinian protest demonstrating outside the memorial service for former First Lady Rosalynn Carter. And you go, why? Why would you protest out in front of this woman's funeral? Why would you do this to the Carters? Understand, this is someone who has been the peace guy. This is someone who supported the two-state solution for decades. This is not the guy you protest and his wife. You just don't do that. And it shows the idiocy of some of these people. And it shows, again, this, what did you gain from that? Other than you getting people like me who have kind of stayed out of this issue going, what is wrong with you? And it shows the coarseness of where we are. And look, it didn't get an awful lot of attention anywhere else other than the Twitter sphere. And I think most of it was negative, going, hey, stupid, this is not the place. But it goes to show that there's either we have lost our ever-loving, flippin' minds, or there's some money behind this. No decent person would do that. Look, I get the passions, I get that, but not the place. Not the place. Also today, the thing that did get the news, and this is another thing that have we lost our minds? Is no one paying attention? Evidently, Hunter Biden has said that he would be happy to come and testify before the House Oversight Committee, James Comer and his attack group, but it's going to have to be an open hearing. No behind closed doors, no smoke-filled rooms, none of that stuff. Comer losing his mind, going, no, you're going to have to, we'll see you behind closed doors. And what I find interesting is not that, look, that Comer and Republicans don't want Hunter Biden's words public and that they want to go and be able to misrepresent anything that happens behind the closed door. Because, hey, it was behind closed doors. Who's to say what was actually said? Who's to say what really happened other than these people who have been known to, misrepresent things? Lie? Maybe you remember the last bits? And this comes at an interesting time because you've got Hunter Biden and James Biden going, look, we'll testify, but you're not going to twist our words. You're not going to do what you do. Not going to do it. Now, Comer says he expects Hunter Biden to be there on the 13th for a closed door meeting. And, as I'm reading through this, I went, okay, I'll go behind closed doors when Scott, pardon me, Perry, and Jim Jordan honor their subpoenas to testify, to be deposed behind closed doors. Okay, we'll trade that. Now, we know Scott, pardon me, Perry, and Jim Jordan, they will not. And this is the hypocrisy of this. This is how just crazy this is bad. For months you've had these Republicans, Comer in particular, whining and complaining, oh, they're not honoring subpoenas. And they've been making up all kinds of conspiracy theories that they have no proof over. None. But hey, they get to just keep throwing it out there. So Hunter Biden's like, I want to clear my name. So what did our right-wing media do today? And this, look, I understand Comer wanting to hide behind the smoke-filled backroom door and be able to make stuff up. I get that. Because this is nothing but a witch hunt in epic proportions. This is nothing but, hey, we got somebody who did something wrong. Let's pin everything on him. What I found interesting is as I was watching the F channel and the O channel and the Max channel and all of the crazy right-wing stuff, they were all defending Comer saying this has to be behind closed doors. They were actually going, yes, we want the hearing behind closed doors. I'm going, who in media has ever said that? And it made me wonder who's writing the right-wing script right now, because all of them were on board. I did not find one right-wing commentator, tells you how in line they are, who said, no, nonsense. I want this in public. I want to see with my own two eyes that guy squirm in the seat. I want to hear his words. I want to see Jim Jordan tear him apart. I didn't see one person say that. And that's the, now I'm not saying no one did, but he's been quashed somewhere. But for me, it doesn't matter who. I want to see this stuff. That's the reason of having hearings, so that we the people can make the choice. But again, I come back to a lot of this stuff is all, it's all bread and circus. It's all American Idol and Cheetos, however you want to frame that. It's all entertainment. And it's all outrage. For instance, you now got Utah Senator Mike Lee. Maybe the guy that was sentenced to 4 years in jail, this Kevin Lyons, for his activities on January 6th. Maybe he wasn't a federal agent disguising as a Trump supporter. Maybe he wasn't. Because if you listen to the right wing, it's all, well, they're all federal agents. It's all staged. And one after another, well, we don't really have any evidence. And I love Maria Bartiromo, because sometimes she trips over asking an actual question. And again, this comes back to, on that side, you don't ask the question unless it's scripted. She asked Michigan Republican Representative Lisa McClain, if anyone had actually seen any policy changes that Joe Biden made with regards to China for the payback that they claim he got. Because the argument is that Hunter Biden and Joe Biden, the big guy, made millions of dollars, and Joe Biden changed policies specifically to get what Hunter was selling. And this McClain, said, no, short answer is no. Because there's nothing. But they can't tell you there's nothing because they need the outrage. They need the daily outrage. This is it. This is today's outrage. Hunter Biden won't testify behind closed doors. Find me one American who's going to go, no, no, I want him to testify behind closed doors. Find one outside of the right-wing outrage machine who got their marching orders today. This is me going, we're in a weird moment, folks. We are in a very strange time where it's not about truth. It's not about getting facts. It's about playing the game. It's about engaging in the outrage of the day and the things we should be outraged at. Well, we're not. You know, I've been saying for a while, we should be fighting for things that make our lives better. And we should stop fighting over things that are nonsense. This whole thing that the Republicans have dreamt up, because this is all payback for Trump's impeachments. Understand that. This is all payback. And if you think this is ridiculous, if Trump gets reelected, oh boy, you will see ridiculous on steroids. So look at this. Pay attention what the right-wing media is spinning. This idea that, you know, I could not believe my eyes and ears as I watched these people say, you know, well, we should have this should be, we shouldn't get to see this stuff. You know, it's best when it's behind closed doors because we can really get in and get to the meat and potatoes of things. We can really? So the question I have is, do you buy it? And can you look at them with a straight face? That's what I want to know. Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. I got a lot to get to, a lot to talk about. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Back after this. Stick around.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I gotta tell you, the Pope, I like this Pope. I like him a lot. Now, granted, as a broken Catholic, I don't go anywhere near the Catholic Church anymore, but this Pope gives me hope. He's quoted saying that Christianity in America is just a money-making scheme. He's slamming, American Christians for basically turning their religion into a cash cow and an ideological circus. And it's what it's become. It really is. And look, this isn't new. You may remember back in August, the Pope said that conservative U.S. Catholics have replaced faith with ideology. It's what they believe is in the book, not what's actually there. So very, very interesting times. Let's quick go to the phones. I got Steve on line one from Chicago. Steve, what's on your mind, brother?
Well, a couple of things, and I do think it's interesting that this Pope would offer up that kind of commentary. And keep in mind that this is a time when in Europe and in America and many other parts of the developed world, religion is on the decline significantly. The number of people who are actually going to church differs from those who proclaim themselves as having a belief in a higher power, which obviously does nothing for the bottom line for churches.
Yep.
You know, okay, you believe in God, but if you're not showing up or giving, then, you know, that doesn't do us much good. And the reality is that the Catholic Church is particularly in trouble with regard to faith because, obviously, you know, very few people in terms of younger generations, if you're a man, you know, is willing to embrace the idea of, okay, well, I'm not going to be able to get married, I'm not going to be able to have children, and I want to become a priest. Well, people aren't willing to make that sacrifice, so now the Catholic Church actually sees itself taking in priests who were married before they became priests, and now they're ordained as having been married, and that's fine with the church, something that was unheard of just a few decades ago. You know, but the church is desperate. You know, they have congregations without priests, so you need to sort of bend. I'm a non-believer, but I was raised in the Eastern Christian faith, the Greek, Russian, Serbian Orthodox faith, and we were part of the same church until what's called the Great Schism, in which East and West the church divided. But for us, we never prohibited priests from being married or having children. And the reason that the Catholic Church did was because, you know, it's not like today where everything's connected and you can know with a few keystrokes exactly how much money a church took in Outer Mongolia in a given week or month. So what the church basically said, you know what, we don't want priests getting married because when it comes time to pass on whatever property or legacy that exists within that church, they will give it to their children and their wives. So the Catholic Church, you know, created this nonsense that, oh, no, you're married to the church. And, yeah, you don't take a wife and you don't have children. It was about the bottom line the entire time, you know, because there are a lot of Christians who are still around who never adopted that philosophy. That was just something made up out of whole cloth. And a lot of Catholics believe that it's something that originated in the original Christian church. And no, that came along much later. So, That's point one. And two, and you're absolutely right with regard to this whole question of why the Republicans don't want to have public hearings. I mean, you know, you want public hearings when you have something that you could actually nail somebody on. You know, what they want is this just to continue to be something that they can beat to death, claiming that, well, you know, as soon as we get him up there, you know, we'll break him and everything will be exposed and revealed and so forth. They don't have anything. They know they don't have anything.
Yeah, but even at that,
so,
Steve.
Obviously.
But even at that, why not do that in public? Why this want behind closed doors? This has never been something they've ever wanted before.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, again, they know they don't have anything, so it's going to happen behind closed doors. And, you know, like I said, I mean, what you want is a giant campaign commercial. If you can really nail somebody, then, yeah, you want the whole world to see it. Like you said, I mean, they're all on the same page with regard to this because for obvious reasons. You know, if you don't have anything, then you're going to look like an idiot. You know, some mainstream voters are going to look out there and say, wait a minute, you people have been promising us the beast for years on this, and this is what you came up with?
You got zip.
You know, so.
But look here, yeah, Steve. Here, Steve. I understand the politicians wanting this. I don't understand the outrage machine saying, yeah, we're okay with you hiding behind closed doors. These are people who need the daily outrage. And today's outrage was going, they refuse to do this behind closed doors. That's insane to me. That's the insane part.
Well, yeah, and let's keep in mind, I mean, depending upon who you're talking about, I mean, there's very little distinction between, you know, the sort of right wing in this country and some things like Fox and One American News and Newsmax and so forth. I mean, so, you know, they have to be on the same page. It's not as if, I would say, like, for instance, your show and others like it, you know, you're not some sort of paid mouthpiece for the Democratic Party. You don't take your marching orders from them. You would never do that. But for the Republican Party, it's increasingly the case that they're just, you know, you have to be in lockstep. You're part of the team. And if you're not interested in being part of the team, then you have no access. You're not going to get any interviews. You're not going to be part of the whole process. So you have to be, you know, in lockstep with the party and with the party line. So, yeah, I'm not at all surprised. I mean,
and with the moneyed interest.
There are people.
You know, let's not forget the moneyed interest. Now, let's not forget the people who pay their salaries. I think I confused him. Did I lose Steve? I think I lost Steve. Well, I appreciate the call, Steve. Thanks so much. Let's move on to Jack in Wisconsin on line two. Jack, how are we doing today, buddy? Uh-oh. Did I lose Jack, too? Jack, you there? Uh-oh. That isn't good. I guess we lost Jack. No, and this is again one of these things where, you know, my mind goes to this place where you go, remember, these are the people who, you know, they want the news. And yet, you know, it's okay. Don't worry. They'll take care of it behind closed doors. Now, the Catholic thing. You know, I grew up Catholic. One of the reasons I call myself a broken Catholic is because I grew up in poverty. I grew up, there were months there was no food in the house. The mice were going, hey, where's the food? And what would happen is on Monday, the church would call and say, hey, you know, we got this envelope in the collection plate. There's no money in it. There's not a dime in the collection plate. And, you know, we would go, hey, you know, there's no money in the house. And they would call every Monday, knowing that we were in this situation, knowing that we were struggling. And this is what they would do. And it's part of the reason that, you know, look, I don't play into it. And that's part of the reason that we left. And it's because, you know, it's that greed factor. You know, and I just refused to do it. Let's see who's on line one. I got Jack in Wisconsin on line one. Jack, how are we doing today?
Just peachy keen, except it's gone from summer to winter here in about 36 hours.
Yeah.
But other than that, it's been good. I just had a kind of an observation. The Republicans not wanting to have people listen in on these hearings. I mean, we've seen this in Wisconsin again and again, where the Republicans hold a closed door so-called hearing, and they only invite certain people that are going to be speaking on a subject in a certain way. It's just part of their method of trying to engender you know, hate and fear and anger into their cultists. Latest thing in Wisconsin is they're trying to get a bill through our legislature where every library supported by public funds is required to report to the parents what library book specifically their child is taking out of the library if they're under 16 years of age. And again, this is just a matter of they're trying to limit they're trying to intimidate people from checking out certain kinds of books. They're trying to limit people's information. This is very typical. My question is this, though. When do you think, because it's got to be exhausting, constantly feeling this hate and this anger and this fear, it's just got to be exhausting to their cult and to the so-called right-leaning independents. When do you think it's going to be so exhausting they're just going to say, I give up, I'm not even going to bother, not just, you know, I'm not going to vote for anybody that keeps on pushing this kind of thing.
Yeah, I don't see that stopping. Fear is an incredible motivator, and they're great at playing the fear card because the others are coming for your stuff, Jack. The others are coming for your children. The others, and you know that fear of the others is an incredible motivator. It's just scary stuff. But I appreciate the call, Jack. Thanks. Let's move along to Alice on line three. Alice, what's on your mind here?
Well, you got phone gremlins for one thing.
Okay.
Are you still? Hello.
Go ahead. What's on your mind?
What I wanted to say was, well, what I'm thinking is, why do they want it behind closed doors? Couple of reasons. Number one, they don't want at the base to hear. I'm sure Hunter Biden's going to be in attack mode. And second of all, it's so much easier to twist things that are said when it's behind closed door. So much easier to twist it.
Absolutely.
Exactly. And finally, what I wanted to say was the Pope is certainly not lying about American Christianity. Have a good evening.
Thanks, Alice. Let's quick go back to Steve real quick with about 15 seconds. Steve, what's on your mind, buddy?
Yes, just wanted to close with this. I do think one of the other big stories today, you know, Americans for Prosperity endorsing Nikki Haley. I do think it says a great deal about where the business interests lie in this country, and
yep.
It's not with Donald Trump. It's very hard to do business in a society mired in civil war, and that's not what a lot of the big business interests in this country want.
No, I'm right there with you. Appreciate it, Steve. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The Koch folks, they're all behind Haley. So it'll be interesting. Yeah, there's a lot of money there. A lot of money there. Gonna take a quick break, right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So one of the things I'm very happy about is in the last election, at least in my backyard, misery maniacs for moms, you know, the Moms for Liberty group locally, they got beaten. And I got to tell you, I was sweating it out because they had some crazy ideas and some crazy thoughts on what they wanted to do with my kids' local public schools. And look, all across Pennsylvania, the Yaz money, the billionaire money didn't go very far this time. But trust me, they're not going anywhere. And here to share some thoughts on the election cycle and maybe where things are heading, I've asked Randy Weingarten to come talk with us. Randy is the president of the American Federation of Teachers, AFT. Randy, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you, Rick. And I'm so glad that the election in your backyard went very much like the elections all throughout the country. So it was a good news day. This first Tuesday in November, or this election day in November.
No, but I look at this and, you know, this gives me some hope. I got to tell you, I was a little concerned, a little down, because all you keep hearing are these attacks, the right-wing media machine. All they were talking about is the most obscene, the most outrageous stuff to get people all lathered up and all angry so that they would go out and vote for these extreme people. And fortunately, the voters didn't allow it. So for me, it gives me a little bit of hope.
Well, I think what's happened is that there is a group of extremists. They're mostly, when it comes to schools, they're mostly in the right wing. I wouldn't actually even call them conservative, because what they're dedicated to is ending public education as we know it. And Rufo, you and I have spoken about this. Rufo, who was one of their acolytes, you know, made sure that he told us, which was that in order to get to universal vouchers, which essentially means destruction of public education as, you know, an institution for all kids, you have to create universal public school distrust. And that's what these groups that these extremists like Yaz have funded, like, are trying to do. Yeah. And this time, you know, as I think what has happened is, as we get farther away from COVID, even though there's still lots of issues that resulted from COVID that schools have to deal with, that parents are dealing with, that kids are dealing with, that teachers are dealing with. But as we get farther away, what you're seeing is that parents want us to be dealing with loneliness and learning loss and absenteeism and dysregulation, you know, and the disconnectedness, and they don't want us dealing with book banning or censorship of coursework or anything that undermines the education and the opportunity that their kids should be getting.
Yeah.
And I think that you saw that in these elections, that even though the other side had a lot of money, Yaz, for example, put a lot of money into these extremist groups like Moms for Liberty and others, and people came out and voted for the pro-public education candidates.
Now, again, as I said at the beginning, they're not going to stop. The money will not stop flowing because, as you've pointed out, the goal is eventually to destroy public education, privatize and profitize Education Incorporated. And everywhere you look, there are these attacks. And you brought up absenteeism. There was an article that I saw that, you know, that grabbed my attention that said, look, you know, American public schools are on their last legs. The portion of students attending a school with chronic absenteeism has doubled since pre-pandemic times. And they go through saying, you know, teachers are, you know, are looking around and nobody's in the classroom. They're painting this dire picture. Is that what you're seeing in the classroom? Is nobody showing up? Is it as bad as being painted?
No, of course not. But that's what sells papers. But what is happening is this. What COVID did do is it told a generation of kids, because of the mishandling of COVID in this country and the lack of prioritization of schooling in this country, schools were closed for an awful long time. Now, I want to actually say, as carefully as I can, that some of us from April 2020, and Rick, I was on your show a lot, you heard me say it, some of us understood that closing schools for in-person learning was a problem. And from April 2020, I tried to figure out how to reopen them with the caveat that they had to be reopened safely, that right. We had to deal with the pandemic. But,
see, but you don't hear that, you know, if I can stop you. You don't hear this when you listen to the F channel of the right wing. It's Randy Weingarten, yeah. Shut down all the schools.
Right. And frankly, I wish I had 1/1000th of the power they attribute to me. I would assume that I would do a far better job. But, you know, I'm not in charge of any school system. And the school systems that I actually work with the most of them were open, pretty early on. Having said that, they, from April 2020, we understood that we needed to reopen schools for in-person learning and do it safely to make sure that teachers and kids and their families were as safe as humanly possible. But what I'm saying is that act, even in places that stayed closed for 3 months or 4 months, March, April, May, June, what happened is that kids lost the sense, and families lost the sense, that this was absolutely imperative to go to school in person. And I think that we are suffering from that. And I think that's why you're seeing so much absenteeism. The solution for that is the solution that we should have been doing for schools all the time, which is we need to make schooling important to kids. It needs to be fun. It needs to be engaging. It needs to be relevant. It needs to be practical. Kids need to get up in the morning and say, that's where I want to be. And frankly, in a period of time of so much dissonance everywhere, we need to make sure that kids have a safe and welcoming environment and a well-rounded education. So the way to solve the issues of absenteeism is the way that we should be doing schooling anyway, which is making schools, public schools, places where parents want to send their kids, educators want to work, and kids are really engaged.
Yeah, but you know, I go back to when, you know, look, it's been years since I've been in school. You didn't have a choice. There was a truant officer. There was someone who came to your house and drug you if they had to. So for me, this idea that there's an option, this to me is a struggle. I mean, because like my kids, they know that they don't have a choice. They got to get up every morning and they got to drag themselves to school, and they better learn something, because this is their one shot at an education. This is their one opportunity to use this time wisely and the best that they can. And I can't understand parents who don't push that kind of a mentality.
Well, I think, you know, I want to give a little bit of grace to parents in America right now. There's a lot of stuff, particularly in a climate of so much divisiveness and so much fear.
Yeah.
There's a lot of stuff that's tough. But what I'm seeing more and more this year in particular is that school is center of community, and school is a place that parents and kids see as really important. 90% of kids in America still go to public schools. And, you know, so we're seeing an increase in homeschooling. We're seeing an increase in absenteeism. We need to understand what is going on and how to address issues. That's why I keep saying, let's address the loneliness. Let's address disconnection. Let's address issues like learning loss. Let's address issues like gun violence in schools. Let's address all of these kinds of things. And frankly, when we do this, you're going to see more and more kids going to public schools, even though you're already seeing it, the attendance rates, or you're certainly seeing the enrollment rates tick up again.
You guys have been running this campaign, Real Solutions for Kids in Communities. And a part of that is, I as I understand, you know, making it the center of the community. You know, when I was a kid, look, you used to go on, you know, off hours and get to play in the gym and play basketball in the summers. You know, when I was a kid, you it was a place where you got a hot lunch before Reagan destroyed that program. It was that place where you got services and help and all kinds of things. It was that glue that held, you know, even the poorest community like I grew up in, it's what held things together. Now, most schools, sadly, you know, they lock the doors and it's like an armed camp at this point. And it's not that kind of welcoming, open place that I want it to be.
Look, I think that there's lots of issues around, you know, the environment and what's happening in America right now. Every single issue ends up at the school doorstep. And what we're saying is, you know, instead of fighting about it, let's solve these problems, because schools are centers of community, and let's make sure we prepare kids for today and tomorrow. That's our obligation, and teachers should be supported in doing that. In doing that work, and that's really important.
Yeah.
And we need the resources and we need the support. But, you know, that's why we're focused on, in terms of this Real Solutions campaign, what are the major issues that are challenges? Literacy is a real challenge. That's why we are, you know, giving out books to help kids become confident readers. But we're also helping teachers understand the science of reading so that they can help kids with all issues and challenges around literacy. But that's also, to your point about food security, that's why lots of states are basically saying, stop with the lunch shaming and let's make sure we have vital breakfast and lunches for kids all the time without question. And frankly, what we're seeing the Republicans do in the Congress is, as they're cutting they're cutting SNAP and nutrition issues, states are building it up. But that's what we're talking about community schools and wraparound services. Let's make sure it's there so we level the playing field for kids. I mean, you know, Rosalind Carter, her funeral was today. Think about what she did in trying to help make sure that kids have a real opportunity and a chance for success. But in addition to community schools and wraparound services and making sure we address mental health concerns and loneliness concerns and taking on the social media companies and their algorithm, the thing that I'm most excited about our campaign is this point about experiential learning and hands-on learning.
Yep.
In a period of time of AI and application and needing to apply knowledge and critically think and discern fact from fiction, we have to give kids the skills to do that. That's not about memorization. That's about application. So let's have more experiential learning. This is what private schools do all the time. Why are we not doing it in public schools? And let me tell you one thing. When we do this, like in career tech ed, kids come to school, they graduate on time, and they have lots of options in terms of college and career. So let's do more career tech ed. Let's do more advanced manufacturing. Let's make, you know, do more healthcare work in high schools. Let's make sure we really give kids the skills and knowledge and opportunity to, so they're prepared for life, for civics, for career, for college. And so as others smear and as others, you know, basically throw obstacle after obstacle at us, what the AFT is doing and what teachers do in classrooms every single day is try to make school a place that kids want to be and a place that's compelling and interesting and where we help create opportunity.
There you go. I got to get your thoughts on this Pioneer Institute, you know, push that they're making. And again, the Pioneer Institute, you know, one of these right-wing free market think tanks whose solution to everything is privatize and profitize. But they're out running around saying, asking the question, why are public schools quashing civics and history? Are you guys doing that? Are you deliberately saying we're not going to teach kids civics and history? Because according to them, you know, only fewer than half of the people can name the three branches of government. A quarter of the people can't name any branch of government. They've got some statistics that are fairly frightening. Are you the guys who are quashing civics and history?
You mean, Rick, you're saying that to a social studies teacher who loves teaching civics and history? Let me actually answer it this way. No Child Left Behind, by creating an accountability system that was fixated on test scores in math and in English, was the first, was when we started seeing civics being squeezed out of the curriculum. And if you have, as we've had with all of these fights around censorship and whether or not you can teach current events and all of this, you know, banning of books, what has happened is that teachers are chilled out of teaching about current events. You can't even teach about the elections. How do you teach civics if you can't actually teach about current events?
Yeah, and then this comes back to where we started, you know, though, with these maniac moms for misery groups who are out there, you know, trying to armchair teach.
Exactly. So you can't. So when somebody says the kids don't know the separation of powers, it's not about memorization of, you know, this is the presidency and this is the Congress and this is the Supreme Court. How are you going to know about the Supreme Court if you can't actually teach, you know, what happened in the Dobbs decision in high school, how or what happens in any other decision? And so what's happened is that these groups are speaking out of both sides of their mouth. This civics is not about memorization. Civics is about application. And you have to teach kids how to think, which means that controversial topics, sometimes things that are conflictual, you have to teach. And they don't want us to do that. And that's, you know, so you can't say to a teacher, don't teach a divisive concept. Slavery is a divisive concept. Don't teach a divisive concept and then complain later on that we're not teaching civics. Come on.
Yeah. Lastly, before I let you go, obviously, as you brought up earlier, today was the funeral of former First Lady Rosalynn Carter. Any thoughts on her passing, on her life? Any thoughts?
Look, today was, I was not there, but in watching the pictures and in listening to the speeches, the fact that all those first ladies were there, the ones, everyone who's alive was there, was an amazing tribute to her, including, I was glad to see Melania Trump there. It was just an amazing tribute. And first ladies play a really important role in this country. And you see that with the role that Joe Biden is playing. They are helping heal the soul of the country. And Rosalynn Carter was a first lady extraordinaire. and she really worked to ensure deep humanism in this country. And I think I'm glad that she and President Carter have, over the last two decades or so, really gotten their due for the amazing patriots that they are.
Yeah. We need more Carters, most certainly. Randy, I appreciate you taking some time for us. As always, thanks so much.
Thank you, Rick. Take care.
Randy Weingarten, president of the American Federation of Teachers. I want to hear your thoughts. How are things in your school district? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Right back after this. Stick around. You'll listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1908. That was the day that an explosion at the coal mine in Mariana, in Washington County, Pennsylvania, claimed the lives of 154 miners. It was one of the deadliest disasters in U.S. mining history. The Mariana mine was on the Pittsburgh coal seam, one of the richest coal deposits in the country. The mine was operated by the Pittsburgh Buffalo Coal Company. It was considered by many to be a model operation. The company houses that surrounded the mine were made of yellow brick, had hot and cold running water, and electric lights. This set them apart from other mining homes of the day. By the early 1920s, 90% of all mining homes were wood-framed, and less than 20% had electricity. Yet even though Mariana was considered a model, disaster still struck. Mine inspector Harry Lewitt had been on site for 2 days leading up to the disaster. On Saturday morning, he had just left a mine shaft. According to newspaper reports, he found the mine in, quote, perfect condition. Then, shortly after 11 a.m., came a horrific explosion that left experts puzzled. It was believed that a vein of natural gas caused the deadly blast. Only one man, Fred Ellinger, was rescued from the mine. He gave a harrowing account of what happened to the Washington Observer. He said, quote, "I was working at laying brick in one of the entries, and the first thing I knew, a terrible explosion took place, which threw me some distance. My two buddies were also tossed some distance away. I heard them for a while, then all was quiet." Ellinger was rescued, but 154 other men were not. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So I'm looking at the this article by Jonathan Last over at The Bulwark. And this is one of those things that gets me about some reporters. And look, I don't know Jonathan Last very well, but he's got this piece, you know, about Chris Sununu. And it's titled Chris Sununu and the Good Republican's Noble Lie. And, you know, it's basically, you know, Sununu trying to play the role of the, as Last puts it, you know, the certified good Republican. And look, he had some things, you know, that weren't overly glowing about Trump and, you know, trying to play middle of the road, saying, hey, he's not going to be the nominee. That's not going to happen, you know. And look, you know, Trump was at 45% back then, and it's gotten worse. So now he's come out, and he is saying, well, you know, he's weighed the options. He's done his research, and now he's come up with I'm going to vote for Donald Trump. And here's the thing, and this is where my mind goes to this place, because Jonathan Last says there are only three explanations for this about face, for Sununu, you know, falling in the line, if you will. One, he's stupid. Two, underwent a genuine wholesale reevaluation. He grew to love Donald. Or Sununu was lying about what he really thought. And you go, well, yeah, and he's right. Look, three is probably the most plausible. But I never bought any of that from the beginning. And this is where you go, they've told us who they are. Why do we keep falling for it? Why do we keep being Lucy'd? Lucy pulls the football away every time. There is no scenario where Charlie Brown gets to kick the ball. Doesn't happen. But here we are again in this moment where I guess it is what it is. And I guess, are we surprised by it? The answer, not so much. Got about a minute to go. We got Ronathan on line one from Cincinnati. Ronathan, how are you?
Hey, how are you doing,
sir? I'm good. What's on your mind, brother? Quick.
Well, just real quick, I wanted to say I'm a longtime viewer, and you're a real sexy man. I'd love to put my...
thank you, Ronathan. I always like a good compliment. that hasn't happened in a while. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. I'm always willing to take a compliment when one is thrown my way. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Quick break, right back.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I talk a lot about workers' rights and the idea of organizing for better wages, hours, conditions. I say that quite often, but also throw in their opportunities. And I've been saying that the old frame of wages, hours, conditions, that just rolls off the tongue. But I throw more in that because I think we're in a moment right now where organized labor needs to be that fighting force that creates that opportunity for working people, be it through education, be it through healthcare, be it through where you live. Can you afford a house? And the question that has come up is affordable housing the new battlefront for workers' rights? And here to help answer that question is the reporter who asked the question, wrote the article for our good folks over at Capital in Maine, Vanessa Wong. Vanessa, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, you know, this is a topic that, you know, I've talked about, you know, for some time. This idea, yeah, wages, hours, conditions, certainly, but opportunities and housing being a huge part of that, because we're being priced out of being able to buy homes. And it's gotten to the point now where you have these huge hedge funds who are buying up all the rentals. We can't rent homes anymore. So where do we live? And I love the fact that this is now a workers' rights issue.
Yeah, I mean, it was really surprising to me. I spoke with unions around the country who are advocating for affordable housing, either at the bargaining table or outside of the bargaining table. So they're using their platform to either negotiate with their employers for, I mean, wages is one thing, right? But to specifically ask for affordable housing solutions as part of their contract, and also using their platform to do some political advocacy to push for regulation of the housing market so that all of the progress that they make with their contracts and wages aren't immediately eroded by increases in housing prices, which is what we've seen for, I mean, at least
decades.
Decades. I mean, it's in my adult life, that's been the story of the economy. You know, you get a raise and your housing costs. I live in New York City. Your rent goes up, you know, at least whatever your raise was. These days, inflation is eating into people's earnings so much. So it just really feels like no matter how much your wages go up, you know, through the work of the hard work of a lot of union negotiation, there's sort of like no progress in anyone's quality of life. And I think that's why people I have seen so many surveys recently about people feeling kind of gloomy about it.
Yeah, no, just yesterday we talked about the Wall Street Journal survey that said, you know, that people don't believe that the American dream is possible. That phrase that I grew up believing, if you work hard to play by the rules, that you get ahead. And sadly, that's not happening. And, you know, the first time I saw this be, you know, the housing issue be part of a union contract fight, I think it was with Google, I think if I'm not mistaken, where the bus drivers and folks were like, hey, we have to sleep in the buses. We have nowhere to live. We can't live in San Francisco on the pittance that we're being paid here. And this is, for me, I look at this as a moment for opportunity for policymakers to get involved and to do something. And I think back to, you know, my grandparents' generation. When my grandfather came back from World War II, we had a policy in this country to build, you know, good, solid, low-cost housing for those soldiers and their families to live in. You know, we planned Levitt towns all across this country. I don't know why we're not doing that right now, given the fact that housing is so completely outpriced and hedge funds are buying up all the rentals.
Right. I mean, yeah, it was very interesting to learn about the history of union work on affordable housing issues. In New York City, there was a lot of union-developed affordable housing, actually, in the earlier part of the 20th century. Back then, there were union banks that were able to, you know, provide financing for these projects. There was a lot of political interest in this issue, largely as a result of, I think, like housing quality. You know, I think in New York City, there was a big push to build quality housing for people where living conditions weren't good for many. And we saw many thousands of units of affordable housing built over, you know, that early part of the 20th century. And it later just became something that the government and the private market took over afterwards. And I think we've seen where that's gone.
This is where I completely agree with the idea of a public-private partnership. Sadly, what's happened, you know, my grandparents' era public-private partnership was we use public money to get private firms to do things in the public's interest that benefit we the people. What that has morphed into is we use public dollars to enrich private interests for the goal of enriching private interests. And then we the people, we the working folks, we just get stiffed.
That's right. I mean, it was interesting to talk with, you know, Local 26 out in Minnesota about how they, you know, one of the main issues they have with some of these partnerships, the way that their local government is dealing with affordable housing is flawed because the definition of what's affordable is really out of reach for the typical working class person these days. I think in many markets, there's a federal definition. I think it's adopted in a lot of programs of, you know, 30%, right. As long as your income is your housing cost is about 30% of your income. That's the threshold for what's considered affordable. But it's really not. I mean, that's, you know, just having a standard like that doesn't really make sense across the board. 30% of, you know, minimum wage income is really different than 30% of an upper middle class income or, you know, a wealthy person's income. So I just think that, you know, there needs to be more thought about what's going on with a lot of the affordable housing programs that local governments are putting in place because they're not working.
No, this is, you know,
it's indisputable at this point that it's not working.
Yeah, in fact, I was just having this conversation today with one of the station managers, one of our affiliates, and he was saying, you know, I got this great idea on how we can solve all these problems. And granted, it was something that I had talked about years ago and we, you know, we'd gone through. But you go into some of these major cities where you have blight and you have you know, abandoned factories and you have all this stuff, and you just bulldoze all of that and start building from scratch, give people jobs, invest in those communities, give people local ownership to where they can start to build some wealth. We could recreate that prosperous working class of the 50s and 60s if we chose to. The problem is policymakers haven't chosen to do this. We've chosen to give tax breaks to rich people so that they can hoard more and control more instead of making sure that, you know, my kids have an opportunity to do at least as well as I've done.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there was an interesting pilot program. I shouldn't even call it a pilot program, but there was an interesting partnership that the AFT did out in West Virginia, where they developed about 20 units of workforce housing for teachers as part of an economic development program. I think what that city found that was that a lot of teachers, you know, weren't coming to teach at the schools because housing was an issue.
Right.
And it was a challenge. That program was a challenge. You know, I mean, I think it was hard to find funding for something like that. And what Randy Weingarten was telling me was that, you know, what happens is you can't, if you're trying to build affordable housing right now, it's really hard because whatever the costs are, you can't push onto the teachers that you're trying to build affordable housing for, right? So like the funding is a really critical issue that I think needs to be dealt with, because if, you know, there's no, unions can't really be the financier of last resort for right. affordable
No, this housing. Is where government, this is where government has to step in and do this. This is where having higher tax rates on rich people and redistributive policies to ensure that we do have a floor under working people's feet. You know, I ask the question all the time, Vanessa, you know, is, you know, what good's an economy if a large percentage of our people are struggling just for the basic necessities? And government should be that, you know, that vehicle that ensures that everyone has at least that opportunity to work hard, play by the rules, and yes, get ahead.
Yeah. I mean, this is an issue. Affordable housing is an issue that's come up on local ballots for years now. I don't know how it's not everyone's top issue at this point. I mean, the median, the average renter in the U.S. is paying about 30% of their rent for housing right now. That means the average renter, just like your average renter, not even in, you know, a big coastal city, is housing cost burden at this point. This is a major political issue. I don't think that, you know, the market alone is going to deal with it. So I'm just surprised that it hasn't become a bigger issue for, you know.
That's because we don't have a mainstream corporate controlled media who finds this interesting. This is taking from their bottom line. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Vanessa Wong. She's a reporter. She wrote this most recent piece, Is Affordable Housing a New Worker's Right? You can check that out over at Capital in Maine. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at that. And look, I go back to, I think this is something that you're right. I don't know why it isn't something that people are upset about and angry about. I think it has to do with, I'm okay, I'm getting by, somebody else might get something that I'm not. Because that's how we destroy things. That's how we pit people against each other in this country. You know, someone might get something you don't get, Vanessa. So we can't have that, can we?
Right. But, you know, I mean, like, healthcare is such a big political issue right now. It just seems to me that, like, in terms of, like, the share of anyone's wallet, every single month, like, what are you spending your money on? Housing is gigantic, you know? So we'll see. I mean, you know, until then, I guess, like, the unions will continue to sort of drum up some noise about how this issue is impacting their members, because, you know, I think that, you know, over and over again, I just heard that, like, they can't make progress for their members if all of their improvements are just going to go towards a landlord.
No, just, you know, provisions, you know, your housing, your food, your health insurance. You know, what good is a raise if all of it just gets evaporated and you're paying rich people just to exist? Look, we have folks from the Patriotic Millionaires all the time. And the guy goes, I get rich by you making your payments. And he's not wrong. And this is, again, where I come back to, you know, if we had a true free market where, you know, the capitalist principles work, there would be some industrious contractors out there going, hey, there's a market for the kind of homes that my grandparents' generation built. Look, you know, the little bungalows, about 1,200 square feet, solid homes that are going to last for another 100 years probably. But we're cheap. You know, helped raise families. My grandparents paid, I think, like 15, 16 grand in the mid 60s. And by the middle 70s, their mortgage was a day's pay. That's never going to happen in our lifetimes. And it's because that it was heavily subsidized on the front end. And because of the stagflation of the 70s, their raises went up because they had strong unions to say, hey, we're not going to allow your standard of living to go down because inflation has eroded it. You know, 75, I think my grandfather got three raises because of the COLA in his contract. That's what we need to be talking about in this day and age.
Right. Oh, my goodness. If only we could all just build a time machine and go back to the 60s. What a dream.
Well, no, it's we hadn't been sold on outrage media. We hadn't been sold on hooray for me. I'm the individual and the heck with everybody else. We hadn't been sold on the things that I grew up with. You know, the one who dies with the most toys wins. You know, that kind of mentality. Greed is good. You know, they didn't think that way to the extreme. Now, granted, they were greedy and granted they wanted stuff. But they had an economy that was based on, hey, how do we help people? And I think we need to be talking about going back to that. And maybe we need another Great Depression. Maybe we need another painful event like they went through. I don't know. But we need to be talking about the policies that made that generation the most prosperous working class in history.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like we've been through so many painful events, you know, maybe not to the at the same level of intensity as the Great Depression, but I don't know, so little progress has come out of any of it. And I do feel sometimes like 2023 at this point is just like a worse version of 2019, you know. In other words, the pandemic, I don't feel that the pandemic has any long-term improvement on the situation of Americans, right? So
no.
It's just astounding to me that we all experienced this, you know, like unprecedented, I think that was the word that was repeated over and over again through the first year of COVID, unprecedented event. And we decided to just sort of like go back to the way things were before, but like just a little bit worse.
Just worse. And that's the thing that gets me, Vanessa. I've said the same thing, that, you know, we came out of this event and instead of going, hey, we need to pull together, we need to work less, we need to love more, we need to, you know, spend more time with family, we need to do the better things in life. No, we went right back to let's rip each other to shreds. You know, I say all the time, we should be fighting for things that make our lives better instead of fighting over stuff that tears us apart and is nonsense.
Mm-hmm. Yep, absolutely.
So last absolutely. Question I've got for you, because, you know, clearly something needs to be done. I'm sure you see the same reports that I see, that hedge funds are buying up, you know, all the rental properties. You've got, you know, athletes who've got 100,000 homes that they're renting out to people. How do we push policymakers to move in a direction? I know you didn't really go into this in the article, but, you know, is there any thoughts of, you know, maybe how we come back together, how we push for something like this, or is it really just hopeless?
Oh, my goodness. I mean, I hope it's not hopeless, but, you know, I think that I think we've seen people start to mobilize around this, right? The unions are mobilizing. I think, you know, we've seen it on ballots. There were rent strikes, through the pandemic. It's just, there's a lot of different things going on. It's just not clear to me yet what it's all going to add up to. It's no mystery right now that housing's not affordable. Like, I just don't think anybody can really make the case that things are okay the way they are. But I think like there needs to be more clarity and more, I guess, a more collective understanding that this is an issue that needs like to be addressed urgently.
Yeah. No. The failure of our policymakers is sometimes stunning to me. But I look at the system that we have is meant to be this kind of chaos where nothing really gets done, and the status quo is really great for the wealthy. Because they can continue to rob us blind. But excellent piece. I hope folks will take a look at it. The article is Affordable Housing, A New Worker's Right, written by Vanessa Wong. We'll get links out on how you can check the article out over at Cap and Main. Vanessa, I appreciate you taking time for it. Love to have you back again soon.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Thanks so much. I want to hear your thoughts. Is this where we should be battling? Is this something we should be fighting for? Want to hear it? Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back with your thoughts. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
You know, it really is quite remarkable when you stop and think about it. The fact that you go back to the end of World War II, and the policies that came out, the idea that we were going to use tax dollars to build communities for people to live in, that we built swimming pools and parks, and we built all kinds of things that were for the good of we the people. We built the commons. Wasn't for profit, wasn't for special interest. It was for people to lead lives, to raise families. Now you could go, well, you know, but, you know, Rick, you know, and there's always the caveats. It wasn't this way for everybody. And I, absolutely, I'm with you. We can learn from that era and we can make right the things that weren't righted. And there's part of me goes, that's kind of the reason that I don't think we get these things done. We could be building, you know, the same kind of communities that my grandparents grew up in. In fact, you know, I was talking to one of the station managers today of one of our affiliates, and he said, you know, like Baltimore. He goes, you go into parts of Baltimore and it's all blight. It's all, you know, abandoned buildings. It's all problems. It's all chaos. Why can't we take the money that we've, allocated to do certain programs in those areas and just tear it all down? Tear those blighted, dilapidated buildings down and build new housing that, you know, gives people jobs in those communities to build those houses so that they have, you know, ownership of it. And it's not that you have, you know, some slumlord who then owns this new development. No, you get the people to build their communities. You give them jobs. You create that economy right there. And then, you know, when you build it, they will come. And it's not a bad idea. It's something that I've talked about before. You go into places, people need jobs. All I hear from my conservative friends is, you know, you go into Baltimore, you go into Chicago, and it's nothing but crime. It's the murder capitals of the world. You go, no, not all places. You go into any city across this country, I'm sure you're going to find trouble. And those, oddly enough, are places where you have high poverty. How about we address that by creating jobs? I have never been a handout guy. I've never been someone who believes that, you know, we just give money out. I believe in jobs. I believe in union jobs. And I also believe that government should be the employer of last resort. If private corporations won't, they say they can't, but I say they won't create enough jobs for everyone, the private sector has to. Because I do believe there's dignity in work. I do believe there are, you know, people who need jobs. Instead of what we've been doing, which is creating an economy where the handful do very well and, well, the working folks get stiffed. And housing has been one of those areas. Look, you know, my wife and I were just talking about this today. We're, you know, talking about, you know, what we're going to do when we retire a number of years down the road. You know, what we're going to do with our house and, you know, can we move and all this stuff. And I'm going, you know, our mortgage rates are cheap right now. We'd be stupid to move because other houses that you're going to have to buy and all, it's crazy. Now, is there going to be a correction? Sure, there's going to be a correction down the road. But I think that only comes when you start saying, hey, we do need to build more housing, especially on the lower end. I don't know who can afford these $300,000-$500,000 homes. I don't know. Especially in you know, places that aren't major cities. But you I had someone, you know, in California tell me that, you know, $1 million is the cost of a home in a lot of places. And I'm going, who can afford that? What working person can afford that? And the sad reality is, as was pointed out to me, this is how you end up having multiple generations living in the same home. This is how you have, you know, these other scenarios. And I think we can do better. I think as working people, as voters, as citizens, shouldn't we be demanding better out of our legislatures? And what are we getting out of the Republicans in Congress? Because here's the thing, you know, if I suggest this to a conservative, a Republican, one of the red hats, they're going to scream socialism without thinking about the fact that this is stuff that we did to build the prosperity of a generation. My grandparents, when they got married, and they got married for the old-fashioned reason, they had to. In fact, you know, my aunt was, born 4 months into the wedding, because the first one always comes whenever. Everyone after that's 9 months. But they were homeless. They were literally living in their car. And throughout their lives just my grandfather working for, you know, a good 12 years, they were able to buy a couple of homes. They were able to live with dignity and respect. They were able to have a pension and Social Security and savings, and they led a dignified life. You know, most working people, they're not looking to make a killing. They don't want to be Jeff Bezos, but they do want to make a living. And they want to have, you know, as the old bread and roses, bread, yes, but roses too. Just my thoughts.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, I gotta tell you, I'm already looking forward to next Thanksgiving, because the turkey and all that stuff was so great. My wife is an incredible cook and always does really, really good stuff on Thanksgiving. But I also love Black Friday. Black Friday was always a day of activism. You know, for years, I was out at the Walmart, you know, doing the Black Friday picketing out there years ago. And now it's all about the Amazon. And you saw a number of actions across the country and across the globe on Black Friday around Amazon and organizing workers in those places. And here to share some thoughts on, well, how the actions went on Black Friday and, well, maybe what's in store for the coming year. I've asked Randy Corrigan to come talk with us. Randy is the principal officer and secretary treasurer of Teamsters Local 1932 out on the West Coast. Randy, thanks for taking time for us.
Anytime, Rick. Thanks for having me on.
So let's talk about Black Friday. Again, you know, Black Friday has become a day of labor activism. In fact, we've seen a lot of places who are saying, you know, we're not going to have our people working on Black Friday. We'll have these online deals. So the pressure is working in some places, but what's going on at Amazon?
Well, as you can see, I'm sure everybody's been paying attention to the activism all over the world, not just the country. You have locations as far away as the UK, Australia, a number of places that not just you had actions, you have had activity on the floor within the operations, and you obviously had strikes. You had extension of pickets. You had workers walk off the job in a number of areas, North Carolina, you know, the United Kingdom, New Jersey, Georgia, Los Angeles, San Bernardino, Mariloma, all over the place. Workers are just basically taking direct action. And I think the wrap on Amazon is everyone's kind of figuring it out. It's getting more and more obvious. It's getting, you know, and it's funny to see their response all the time. You know, we create great jobs and, you know, we're great to these communities. And I guess they keep saying it, they can't believe their own BS. And if they create such great jobs, why do they have such crazy turnover? If the job is so great, why is there 150% turnover in less than a year?
No, and look, you know, I say this all the time. I worked for a company called Roadway Express for 20 years. And one of the things that they used to talk about is, you know, they were very proud to have a unionized workforce because they had a 2% turnover rate. And they said, look, you know, people come here, they make careers here, they stay here, we train them, they're the best trained workers in the workforce. And they were proud of that. The fact that you have a major corporation in this country who has a 150% turnover, that's a failure. That's what a failure looks like, Randy.
Yeah, like, you know, the days of an employer saying, come to work for me, you can come to work here, we're going to pay you the best, you're going to be able to retire here, we have the best retirement program, the best healthcare plans, we have, you know, basically, they would tout themselves as the best employer, and you can ultimately work your, you know, they wanted to get somebody at 18, 19, 20 years old, soon as they entered the workforce, and keep them as long as possible. That is the complete opposite of Amazon's business model. And what I love seeing is these workers that are taking direct action all over the country. You see them, it's their face on the picket line. It's not mine. I'm the director of division. I'm obviously, I have a little bit to do with some of this, some of these actions all over the country. But we're making sure that those workers are the face of it. Those workers are explaining their reason for taking direct action. Those workers are telling the general public why they're taking on this business model and why this business model is so destructive. You know, it's funny to see Amazon even claim they're great to small business. They're crushing small business. You know, it's one of those things, you keep saying it, I guess you'll believe it. I'd love to see how maybe they're great for some small businesses, but I can point to many, many of them that they're crushing every single day. Well, so small businesses aren't around to point it out.
Yeah, they're good for small businesses in that they put them out of business quickly. It's like, you know, they kill them quickly. They don't let them linger long term.
Yeah, there's not a lot of misery.
Right, it's quick. You know, because look, they are this behemoth that is dominating this market right now. And if legislatively we're not going to do anything, it's got to be the working people who stand up and take and are empowered to do what they're doing. And this is why I do have some faith. I think we're in a moment right now where people have finally said, you know, enough is enough, and are taking some empowerment, are taking some actions. One of the things that I've talked about for years is, you know, when people go, wow, the union. I go, no, not the union, your union, our union, not the, your, our. Engage with it, own it. And I think this generation's kind of grabbing onto that, or do you disagree?
I totally agree. More than 70% of workers in America support unions. The younger generation supports it over 80%. And it's because of these very things that you're talking about. You mentioned something I got to comment on. You know, legislatively, are they going to be able to deal with it? No. Like even if they create some policy, it doesn't do any good unless the workers took direct action to create the policy. The reality is everything in this country that has value for workers has got to be driven by workers that took action to demand a policy change in conjunction with it, not that a bunch of people sitting around think what's best for these workers. Workers at Amazon are taking action, and it is growing by the day. Last year, there was a little bit of activity. Throughout the year, you're seeing ongoing activities. You're seeing extension of pickets. You're seeing workers walk off the job. We're seeing hundreds of workers almost weekly walk off the job over and over and over again. Of course, Amazon's not gonna talk about it. You know, you can't keep a lot of press on this all the time. That's okay. We're not looking to, everybody's not looking to change the world in a minute. The reality is as time goes on, more and more workers are realizing the place in which they're going to have control and power is worker power. As you put it, their union, they're going to take control of these situations. And at the end of the day, they're going to say, hey, Amazon, you need to do a little bit better with your business model. This business model is trash. It is junk.
Yeah. No, I say all the time, it's about wages, hours, conditions, but also opportunities. You know, and just, you know, the last segment, we were talking with a reporter who wrote a piece on, you know, asking the question, is affordable housing a worker's right? And, you know, all of this stuff, you know, comes back to empowering a generation of working people to use the tools at their disposal to make their lives better, whether it is their union or their government, to be pushing for policies. The hope is in both directions like my grandparents' generation did. But at least we're beginning those organizing opportunities. We're bringing people together. That gives me hope for the future.
And the other place that it's happening, Rick, is it's happening at city councils. It's happening at county board of supervisor meetings. It's happening in municipal sort of settings where there's people are recognizing that their civic responsibility that quite frankly they abandoned for quite some time, that their civic responsibility, that platform is a space in which workers can demand those elected officials on a local level impact their everyday too. Like that, not everything is up to Congress. Not everything is up to the Senate. Not everything is up to the President of the United States. Matter of fact, that is where we have failed ourselves, is we put it into that space where it's got to be the NLRB or it's got to be the DOL or it's got to be some huge bureaucracy that takes forever to issue rulings. State agencies, you know, state municipalities, local city government municipalities have the ability to have enforcement. They have the ability to deal with these things. And that's the other thing that we see happening. We see workers, residents, and community taking control of this, joining together on picket lines, saying enough is enough with this business model. Yeah, Amazon's huge. It's big. This stuff doesn't happen overnight. It takes one person at a time.
Yeah. As I say, you want to change the world? Start by your little corner of it. And that's exactly what you're talking about here. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're with Randy Corrigan. Randy's the principal officer and secretary treasurer of Teamsters Local 1932. Their website, teamsters1932.org. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at that and the work that they do. And if you're an Amazon worker and you want to find out more information on how to get involved, how to get active, how to maybe bring the union message to your little piece of the world, I'm sure Randy would be more than happy to help you. So you'll walk me through that. I mean, because clearly I know you're getting calls every day from people going, hey, I saw this. I want to make this better. You know, walk me through what that process looks like for an Amazon worker.
Well, let me back up to you asked a couple things. What's it look like? First of all, last week, 117 people said, hey, we need to deal with this, right? Like 117 came in. Like what's happened, there is literally thousands of workers that are reaching out. And, you know, obviously it takes time. These are massive operations. You got to make sure that this stuff is coordinated in the right way. So what does it look like for somebody who's listening in and who's paying attention? First thing you got to do, you can reach out to the division. You can reach out to my website personally. It doesn't matter. We're going to funnel it all to the same space. And we're going to make sure wherever you're working in your particular region that you're working with all the community groups as well as the unions that are collectively taking this subject on, and everybody's working together. We're going to make sure that you're working together with the workers in that industry. That, in other words, you and UPSers and freight drivers and grocery workers, everybody that's kind of collectively in the same industry, that you're all collectively putting together a demand on the industry and putting a demand on Amazon to say, you need to bring things up to par. You need to have working conditions. You need to have pay, benefits, and a structure in which matches the industry so that there's somewhat of an industry standard. There's got to be a benchmark here. Can't keep eroding. So what does that look like? First thing you got to do is you got to either pick up the phone, send an email, reach out to your local union. Your local union, Teamster local union in the area. All of those things, we make sure that they're funneled into a common space, and we make sure all the appropriate people that are working on it in that particular region is advancing it. And sometimes people say, oh, well, it's not going to move fast enough. Sometimes it doesn't. It depends. You got some areas that got 5, 10, 20. You got 40,000 Amazon workers in the Inland Empire, another 50,000 in the LA base. You got even more in San Diego. So that's a big number in Southern California. Right? You can't move those types of people, you know, with just a snap of the finger. You have to make sure everybody's on board. And the most important thing is, I think the thing that we have all missed, and I love that you say it all the time, Rick, is we got to make sure that the community is alongside with us on this. We got to make sure that community stakeholders, that elected officials and local elected officials and local community organizations are grounded in this work too. Because without that, it won't survive. That they have to, they being those community allies, have to partner up with these workers and demand that their community collectively expects more. That way it's not third party is what this union institution is asking. It's a community that's saying we deserve better.
No, I mean, in that we earn better. We create this wealth. And this is the part that, you know, when I was doing organizing and talking to workers, it's like, look, you create the wealth for this company. You deserve, you earn a portion of that. And, you know, the question is, you know, it's you probably should be getting a lot more than you are. And you get that by, well, by organizing. And this is where I keep coming back to. Amazon is a massively profitable company. We're talking billions of dollars in money going into the hands of the few. The people who create that wealth, I think, earn a lot more than what they're getting. I think the president has talked about this as well, you know, especially with the UAW folks. So last question I've got for you, because you're seeing these successes, the UAW with the Big Three, the Teamsters with UPS. You're seeing a lot of these contracts going.
Culinary.
Right.
Culinary.
Absolutely. That was incredible. We had folks on from that. What's the message going forward in getting people to go, hey, I can do that?
Well, part of it is seeing this activism of workers, right? And I think that looking and seeing they look like one another. They're obviously doing very similar work for one another. And there's a slight difference here. So your culinary, your UPS, and your UAW, those are all contract renewals, right? Which is very different than the space on Amazon.
Right.
The Amazon space is actually building it from the beginning, where
much UAW, like Starbucks.
UPS, yeah, those are all, you know, 100-year contracts, 50-year contracts, culinary, you know, 40-year contracts, right? So there's a system in place where you have automatic expiration. You got triggers and processes that make that take the next step automatically. We're talking about workers organizing on this scale. It is, you know, there's things that aren't definitive. It's not like, well, the contract expires on the 30th of November, and you know, and if we don't get a deal, we're going to go on strike. Things aren't clearly written in that space, so they become a little less definitive. But workers actually have more opportunity to take control in that space once they understand worker power and they understand the rules. Unfortunately, workers in the last few decades have been basically convinced that this process is futile. That you just, you know, companies own everything and it's up to them and you got to give up and just move on. And that goes back to our history of slavery and all that. It's another show we should have a long discussion on. But specifically, what's the message for today is that if these workers can do it, you can do it. And if you don't do it, who's going to do it?
Yep.
Because at some point, we got to do it. We've in the transportation industry, we have seen working conditions, wages and benefits plummet. Plummet because they had a business model, not just Amazon, but what the predecessors of Amazon got away with: temporary workforce, contingent workforce, you know, having everything subcontracted out, every big employer and big corporation escaping their responsibility and dumping it on someone else. Well, what that led to was a degradation in wages, a degradation in benefits as a whole across the board. Now workers are saying, hey, we're not, this is good. These should be good jobs. These shouldn't be transitional jobs. They shouldn't be temporary jobs. And now you're seeing elimination of temporary work. But, you know, workers have got to do more of this. There's not going to be a snap of the finger and go away. It's going to take a lot of years of this activism to push through and for literally millions of workers to push back. I know some people say that sounds crazy when I say that. It's not crazy, Rick. It absolutely has to happen because that is what workers did in the 1920s and 30s and 40s. They moved millions of workers doing exactly what we're talking about right now by taking action in their own hands, withholding their labor and saying, I want a union contract.
No, you're spot on. The old adage, if not you, who? If not now, when? Pretty simple. Randy, I appreciate the time. Love the passion. Hope folks will reach out. Teamsters1932.org, the website. Randy Corrigan, Secretary, Treasurer, Principal Officer there at Teamsters Local 1932. Appreciate the time, man. Thanks so much.
Anytime, man. Thanks for having me on.
Our good friend Randy Corrigan. Again, Teamsters1932.org, the website. Make sure you check that out. Quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1891. That was the day the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Union began in St. Louis, Missouri. At the time of the union's founding, the field of electrical work was very new. Linemen often risked their lives for their jobs. They worked on high power lines, sometimes as long as 12 hours a day. They worked in all sorts of weather, typically earning as little as 15 to 20 cents an hour. In 1890, an exposition was held in St. Louis to showcase a glorious display of electrical wonders. The exposition brought together electrical workers from throughout the United States. At the end of their work each day, the men would gather and talk. They shared stories of their hard work under dangerous and unsafe conditions. They decided it was time to form a union. They reached out to the American Federation of Labor. The AFL sent an organizer named Charles Castle to help them. Soon, Local Number 5221 of the Electrical Wiremen and Linemen's Union was established in St. Louis. But the men knew they had to reach beyond St. Louis. They elected lineman Harry Miller as their president. They then sent him traveling by railroad boxcar to cities like Indianapolis, Pittsburgh, New Orleans, and Milwaukee. Miller helped linemen in these cities organize their own local unions. Delegates from 10 locals, representing less than 300 members, gathered in St. Louis. It was there that they drafted a constitution and adopted a logo, the iconic image of a clenched fist holding two lightning bolts. And with that, the IBEW was born. Today, the union represents approximately a quarter of a million members and is a true spark for the labor movement. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2. Back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So, real quick, I want to let everyone know we're ticking down the days until we're turning off the live microphones and leaving, you know, the live radio space. We will be expanding our free speech TV offerings in the new year. We're going to be doing an hour every day. Still working on the time. I think they're talking about 5 o'clock in the afternoon for our live, for our TV show. That will be every day, Monday through Friday. We will be offering the audio to radio stations. So many of the affiliates that you're listening to us on right now are going to grab the hour. So we are not going to go away. We want to have some interactivity. We want people to continue to email and reach out to us. And we're hoping that this is a way forward. We're hoping that this is a way for us to expand our reach, you know, engage with more people and move into the newer technologies. You know, the sad reality is a lot of people believe radio is dead. I don't. I believe radio is, while it may not be the future in 20, 30 years, I believe it is the now. And we most certainly do need to be engaging in this space. But truth be told, you know, we've got to make our revenue fit our what we're doing to reach folks. So TV seems to be the best way forward for us. And I hope you'll check out freespeech.org. That is where we will be spending our time helping promote that. We're going to be doing a lot more social media and the podcast space. You know, I had someone go, you know, hey, Rick, are you still going to do long form interviews? And I said, you know, we're going to do some of that stuff where we're going to, you know, try and do, you know, some in-depth interviews, but that'll be in the podcast space. So you'll want to subscribe to the podcast so you never miss a moment of what we do. And I got people who are, you know, they subscribe, they listen religiously, and I'm thankful for those folks, grateful for the time that they give us. But yeah, that's where we're going. And as always, all this stuff will be at thericksmithshow.com. Ways to find us, ways to engage, you know, ways to interact. That is our hope. So I'm looking forward to the new year, because I think this is going to be a great opportunity to expand our reach. You know, free speech is in, you know, about 80 million homes across the country. And, you know, with the streaming services that are out there, you know, virtually you, no matter where you are, you can grab this. So the talk is, you know, we're going to take this hour and we're going to do the best the best hour on TV and ultimately on radio. And I'm looking forward to that. It's going to give us some real opportunities. But for all the folks who have been reaching out concerned that they're going to lose us, they're not going to lose us. The RickSmithShow.com is always going to be there for you to reach out and find where we are. I want to finish off with Tommy Tuberville. Now, we talked about Tommy Tuberville the other day, and I believe that part of what he has done and part of the thinking was if you hold up these promotions long enough in the military, you hold enough back that, you know, Trump becomes president, and then you can do what they did, what McConnell did with judges. Only Tuberville, not as smart as McConnell, didn't really think through the whole, hey, the optics, not good. The optics are bad because you're supposed to be the party of the military. You're supposed to be the guys who, you know, when you see somebody in your uniform, you run over there and take a selfie with them. You're there for the photo ops. But Tuberville said, he told his colleagues, I got you into this mess. I'm going to get you out. And he evidently went on, you know, talking about the longstanding traditions of the Senate. Said he would be, it would be eroded if the Senate Democrats passed the resolution that would allow most of the military promotions to go forward. And I go, no, this is what a functional democracy looks like. When one person throws a temper tantrum, when one person has a fit, when one person is the fly in the ointment, the sand in the Vaseline, whatever you want to frame that is, when one guy's the a-hole, everybody else deals with him. And it's about time Schumer starts looking at dealing with the giant you-know-what. So we'll see where this goes. If you miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast. Always there, always available. I want to hear your thoughts. Something I said got under your skin, on your nerves. Hey, I want to join a union. I want to hear it. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Thanks so much for tuning in. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.